This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
In today's conversation, we speak with Jeff Krasno, CEO of Commune Media, an online educational platform focused on personal and societal well-being. He hosts the Commune podcast, in which he explores the ideas, values, and practices that bring us together and help us live a healthy, purpose-filled life. Jeff received his BA in 1993 from Columbia University. In 2008, Jeff created the concept for Wanderlust, a series of large-scale events for well-being that incorporate things such as yoga and art. Wanderlust has hosted more than 65 events in 20 countries. Jeff serves as chairman. Jeff is a contributor to the Huffington Post and Fast Company. He is the author of Wanderlust and Wanderlust Cookbook. In 2016, he was selected by Oprah Winfrey to be part of the Super Soul 100 as one of the nation's leading entrepreneurs. Today, we talk about what wellness truly means, both for the individual and society. Do we have to sacrifice individual wellness for societal wellness? We talk about spirituality and how it can be practiced in many different forms. He shares what he has learned from over 500 podcast episodes and conversations with a diverse set of guests from across the years. Jeff is a very reflective human, and it was so wonderful to learn from his musings. I really enjoyed this conversation, and we hope you do too. Now, on to the podcast. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited to chat with you today. I've listened to a bunch of your podcasts and learned so much every time, and I love the breadth of topics that you cover. So I'm really excited to see where this conversation goes.
Cool. Great to be with you, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to create this platform?
Yeah, well, the simple answer for that is that, you know, you don't need to be a genius to notice that the world is patently unwell, you know, in every aspect, certainly on a physical and psychological aspect. And there's plenty of statistics there that I could prattle on about for some time, but also from a planetary and environmental, political perspective. And those things in my mind have always been very, very connected. So, you know, our mission is to bring well-being to 1 billion people. That's what we wrote up on the wall, or I guess on the whiteboard when we started. And, you know, I feel if we were able to accomplish that mission, you know, you could really bend the arc of the trajectory of both personal and societal well-being.
That's an amazing mission, but I would love for you to define what wellness is. There's a whole community of, you know, wellness folks, and there's a lot of different ways you can go about it. What is health? What is wellness? And especially being in medicine, we obviously treat the acute issues, and we have less time to focus on what it really truly means to be well. So what is your definition of that?
Yeah, well, it's such a multifaceted term, really, because we could talk for semesters on, you know, physiological well-being and psychological well-being. There's, of course, what it means to be socially well, to have your social needs met. I suppose you could be financially well, you know, having your basic needs met in terms of food and shelter that allows you to self-realize. Obviously, there's a component to wellness that is spiritual and feeling a sense of connection to something greater than yourself. So, you know, it's a very protean and broad term. You know, I think, yeah, we are often, at least in Western medicine, kind of define wellness as the absence of disease. And sure, that's a fine definition. No one likes to be diseased. But I think, you know, there's a component to it that needs to be seen through the lens of like what it means to be like truly vibrant and vital and alive. You know, we've focused, you know, for the better part of the 20th century and the 21st century on expanding lifespan or life expectancy, if you will, you know, the years that we travel around the sun, you know, before we pass away. And certainly, you know, the extension of life expectancy can be a metric of wellness. But I think what we've seen, particularly in the West and in the United States, is not just a decrease in lifespan, but a really, really acute decrease in health span. Essentially, the number of years that we spend, you know, maintaining chronic disease and limping through life. I think, you know, the number now is, you know, the average American spends the last 16 to 18 years of their life essentially kind of limping through with at least one chronic disease, often multiple chronic diseases, and just really masking the symptoms of those diseases, you know, with a cocktail of pharmaceuticals, et cetera. So to me, that's not a great portrait of what it is to be well, of what it is to be vibrant and vital and remain curious and in a growth sort of state of mind in life. And so I think, you know, what I'm hoping is that we can kind of change the lens, or I suppose the definition of how we look at wellness, as not just being kind of absent of disease, but also, you know, what it truly means to be stepping into our greatest potential. And I suppose in some ways that's sort of like the human potential movement. You know, for, you know, a century, psychology, for example, studied like what was like fucked up with people. And that was kind of the target of Freud, et cetera. And then all of a sudden kind of Martin Seligman and Abraham Maslow and all these people came around and said, no, wait, hold on. Instead of focusing on what's wrong with people, maybe let's look at like what's right with people and start to bracket human psychology within the parentheses of human potential, of like where we could go. And I think that's an interesting framing for, you know, where we are now in the world of medicine.
That's a beautiful answer. Yeah, I think it's a pretty low bar to say that wellness, being well, is the absence of disease. If you were to start on a wellness journey yourself, or to recommend it to a friend, someone who maybe isn't super chronically ill, but is looking to like prevent diseases, may have a couple of chronic issues, what are some of the fundamental things that you would recommend, or you start looking at when you're recommending someone to go on a journey of wellness?
Yeah, well, I'll start kind of at 40,000 feet and then kind of drill down to specific protocols there. So my philosophy anyways is that, you know, as we mentioned, we've seen this efflorescence of chronic disease. So the question is that where does that come from? You know, where do these cresting rates of heart disease and dementia and diabetes have their provenance? Because if you look back within human history, you know, my physiology is essentially the exact same as my great, 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 great grandfather. My underlying genetics, you know, are essentially exactly the same. You took my hunter-gatherer, you know, ancestor, and, you know, you gave him a shape and put him in a suit and had him walk down Fifth Avenue, and no one would really turn their head. So it's not our underlying genome or our underlying biology that is responsible for disease. It's our lifestyle, it's culture, it's our environment, it's the way that we live and our behaviors that we engage in every day. So there are these evolutionary mismatches that are then causing disease. So then the question is like, well, we could try some technological moonshot and change our genetics. And that seems to be more and more possible with CRISPR and these other technologies. Or seems a little bit easier just to simply change the way that we live such that we align with our adaptive mechanisms, this kind of evolutionary advantages that were so hard wrought over hundreds of thousands of years. And so then from there, you know, you could really just make, I think, the claim that, I suppose, that the origin of chronic disease is really chronic ease. We've engineered our life for convenience now. And, you know, you could look at, you know, the surfeit of nutrient poor, shelf stable, cheap, shitty calories on, you know, the in the aisles of our grocery store. You could look at 24/7 on-demand access to entertainment all of the time. You could look at temperature neutrality, that we have a thermostat on our wall that we can set right to that perfect little Goldilocks zone of 72 degrees. We can look at our big padded shoes and our lush couches that we slump in all day. You know, there's so many ways that we can look at our life through this kind of, through the brackets or within the brackets of sort of convenience and ease. So I would say that if you really want to align yourself with your physiological advantages, all of these mechanisms that provide for longevity and resilience, then make your life a little more inconvenient. So what would that mean? So, like, for example, fasting, like I'm an intermittent faster. We were engineered, this physical organism here was engineered for periods of scarcity, some abundance and then scarcity. But now there is no scarcity. There is no winter, if you will, in terms of being able to access food. We're in a sort of 24/7 consumption pattern in our culture. So now what we need to do is deliberately self-impose some scarcity. Because when you do that, not only do you probably calorie restrict, but you activate all of these pathways in human physiology, like AMP kinase and all these other things that stimulate the repair and restoration systems of the body. So, for example, I would say fasting is a really, really good one that people should experiment with and ease into. Personally, I'm a 16-8 person, so I consolidate all of my consumption into an 8-hour window, more or less. I'm not neurotic or fundamentalist about it. But it really has worked for me. Now, for everyone as bio-individual, especially like if you're pregnant or you're menstruating or, you know, you're going through menopause and all these other things, you know, there's no one right set of protocols for everyone. But certainly the intermittent fasting protocol worked for me. I lost 60 pounds. It helped to essentially manage my blood glucose. I was pre-diabetic just 3 years ago. So it played a huge role in that. You know, I would say for me, like deliberate cold water therapy. So I'm an ice plunger. I absolutely detest the cold. There is no activity in life more ghastly than submerging myself into a bucket of ice.
Hence living in LA.
Yeah. But I do it every day, and I do it before I break my fast. And there's a very particular reason why I do it that way. But I think, you know, essentially becoming comfortable with discomfort not only has its psychological benefits, but it has all sorts of metabolic physiological benefits. Also a huge release of dopamine that lasts, you know, for a couple of days on after a nice plunge. So that is something else that I do. I find it to be incredibly helpful for metabolic health. I'm also an avid sauna taker. So, you know, that's deliberate heat therapy. So that's one that I would also very much recommend. I get 20 minutes at about 200 degrees, 4 to 7 times a week. And that stimulates all sorts of other pathways, production of certain proteins like brain drive neurotrophic factor, things that help your neurons function and actually create new neurons. We never thought that was possible after the age of 25. We're learning a lot. It's called neurobiogenesis. I mean, it seems like you know, doing saunas 4 to 7 times a week can have that benefit. So those are a few. I'm very, very stringent about kind of my sleep protocols, because that was always my Achilles heel, if you will. So I'm very concentrated in when and how I get light and what kind of light at what kind of day to set my circadian rhythm such that my endocrine system stays in balance and I'm releasing the right cortisol at the right time and melatonin at the right time. So I'm, you know, getting proper sleep, because sleep is at, you know, at the substrate of good health. So those are a few that are more kind of on the physiological side. And then I would just say, you know, there's also the social side. You know, our culture really sanctifies the individual. We live in a culture of individualism. Our heroes are these big celebrities, you know, et cetera. We've, you know, consistently boxed ourselves out in and live, you know, in gated communities, inside of fences, inside of houses, et cetera. More and more, especially during COVID, we became reliant on, you know, delivery, et cetera. And we really, really removed ourselves from the social milieu. And obviously, I run a company called Commune, so I'm very concerned with community for all sorts of reasons. And so I think along with, you know, like exercise, like stressing our biceps, you know, for example, and ripping the microfibers in a muscle such that they can, you know, grow and hypertrophize. And we also have to train ourselves at this juncture to meet our social needs. So there's this concept that I'm writing a lot about. Mark Hyman talks about it. Some is called social fitness. And it is like active things that we can do to make sure that our social connections actually meet our social needs. And some of these things are very common and basic and prosaic, you know, just like answering your phone when a loved one calls instead of like engaging in like 40 hours of text messages, you know, or whatever, just saying like, even if you can't talk, just answering your phone. Taking 5 minutes every day to connect with someone that you care about or love, just 5 minutes every day, you know, really trying to not just meet people and build relationships digitally and online, but also actively do that in your own local place and neighborhood, such that we actually start to develop more sense of local community again. And I have like about a dozen of these things that seem very, very simple. But we don't do them. And if we do, we really, really enjoy the benefits of it. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of discussion these days about the blue zones, for example, and how adaptive community is for longevity. I would say that it is an adaptive external phenotype, really. It's like if you look at many of the cultures these days that are living with great health span and lifespan, they're the ones that have the greatest community to them. And, you know, there's also this emerging field of what's called sociogenomics, which is just like, you know, being in connection with someone else is actually changing the way that our genes express, which is a crazy concept that, you know, whether our kind of our genes are being kind of hypermethylated in a way that epigenetically they're expressing in one way or another. So that's an emerging field that people are studying, but it seems to have, you know, some real traction. And I wouldn't doubt that there's more data that's going to come out of that. So those are some of the things that I would start with.
Those are great starting points. It's hard as a physician to recommend some of these things to patients when they have so many other things going on. And like, you really have to be active about your health in the US because there's too much friction to be healthy. Yeah. And the easy choice, or the healthy choice, is never the easy choice.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, I think that wellness used to be just a product of how we just normally lived our life. And now it really needs to be a more of an active choice. And I think that's what you just put your thumb on. And I think you're 100% right, because, you know, in some ways the environmental cards are stacked against us, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, our food culture, our social culture, our environmental culture, certainly our political culture. So, yeah, this is why, you know, we have to take more control over our own lives. The good news, though, there, is that we really have more agency than we ever thought we did. I mean, for the last half of the 20th century, kind of post Watson and Crick, we essentially just assumed that, you know, genetics determined our fate, you know, and And we spent a tremendous amount of effort and resources, you know, mapping the human genome such that, you know, we could find out, well, what polymorphism, you know, led to what disease, et cetera. But really the aftermath of that kind of in the 21st century is very, it's very similar in some ways to kind of what Einstein and Niels Bohr and a lot of the early 20th century physicists to physics, you know, where they said, okay, well, no, actually there is no deterministic world. It's subjective and it's not fixed, et cetera. We're kind of learning that with a lot of the functional integrated medicine doctors of the 21st century is that no, genetic determinism, you know, it's not really all that. Yes, you certainly can have some mutations that give you a much greater, you know, chance or prevalence to contract a certain disease, et cetera. But, you know, what we've learned now with epigenetics and neuroplasticity and the microbiome and all of these emerging fields is that, you know, the human body is not a thing. It's not a product. It's a process. And you cannot separate the process of your organism from the environment in which you live. You are basically an environism or an organment or something. You know, you can't separate it. And it's not fixed. And so when you realize, when you kind of have that satori, if you will, you realize, boy, I have way more agency over how this process is working. Is it moving towards wholeness, which you could call healing, or is it moving towards disease, which you could call ailing? And where am I moving on that spectrum? And what are the things that I can adopt and do in my life to make sure that I'm moving towards wholeness, that I'm healing?
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful. I would love to also touch on the importance of spirituality. And I know that you've talked to a lot of thought leaders, and there's a lot of different ways to practice spirituality and to define spirituality. So why is it important for us to find some spirituality, and how can it be practiced on a spectrum?
Yeah, sure. So I think there's a lot of different spokes to get to the same hub here. There's so many different spiritual traditions, but the central hub is one of connection, of feeling connected to something greater than yourself. So, you know, you could call that Brahman in Hinduism. You could call that Nirvana or discovering the Anatman in Buddhism, or Christ consciousness or unity consciousness in Christianity, et cetera. But I think it always comes down to feeling a sense of mutual interdependence and connection with the world around you, that you are not just some sort of isolated individual kind of wrapped up in an increasingly saggy sack of skin, that, you know, that we are part of something bigger and of something greater, of some greater intelligence. And I think science actually provides a great on-ramp into that realization, because science, whether it's the study of physiology or nature, that's where the metaphysical is patterned in the physical, like everywhere that you look. And so that's kind of been like my great joy in learning more about human physiology, is just the patterns that I see there always point to some greater, bigger concept. This concept of like interconnected systems, for example, like your nervous system and your heart and your liver and your everything that's happening with your digestion and all that, they are all connected. There's no singular boss of one to the other, you know? And so you, as an organism, need to feel that same sense of interdependence and connection with the world around you. And when you do, that is a transformation from the feeling of being a separate self to a feeling of being connected with the cosmos. And so that's what I would say, you know, spirituality at its core is. Now, like, what does that feel like? You know, because certainly some people might have had psychedelic trips, or some people have had meditative experiences where they transcend self and there's only the world, and this kind of subject-object relationship begins to dissolve. There's a greater sense of oneness or unity. But then that kind of dissolves, right, on some level, like after you come out of a peak experience and you come back into this kind of normal life with all these biological imperatives and everything. But I would, there's a concept in Buddhism called the Brahma Vihara, which it has four components. And I like to think about these as in some ways as sort of a metrics, like there's biomarkers for physiology, like, you know, C-reactive protein or homocysteine or, you know, insulin levels or something. This is almost like biomarkers, if you will, for spirituality. So one of them is metta, which is they're all Sanskrit words. So metta is essentially translated or transliterated as loving kindness. So to what degree that are you truly bringing loving kindness to the world around you? You know, there's another concept called karuna, which often people translate as compassion, but you can think of it this way: is to what degree do you identify someone else's suffering as your own suffering? Like, really feel into that. You know, can you really be in someone else's suffering? And if you can, do you feel the inexorable pull to bring loving kindness forward to alleviate that kind of suffering? You know, that's a good gauge for where you are. There's another concept called mudita, which is essentially empathic joy. So just feeling joy simply and for no other reason for someone else's joy. Like, this is a really tricky one, I think, for a lot of people, particularly kind of in the social media era, where it's like you see the accomplishment of someone else, and instead of just like feeling a sense of joy for that person, you feel a sense of kind of comparison or envy, and you project your unfulfilled potential onto that person. And we see that, you know, I see that in myself all the time. And then every once in a while, I'm like, oh my God, my friend published their book and look, they're like opening the box and taking it out. And I just get this sort of surge of energy and joy, and my body starts tingling just for their joy. I mean, that is just, that's a beautiful thing. That's a sense of deeper connection with the world around you. And then I think the last thing I would say here, and this is the last Brahma Vihara, which is another Sanskrit word, and it's called upekkha. And it's often described as equanimity and sort of non-attachment. But I have my own little spin on it, which is, it's really being here now and fully immersing yourself with passion in this moment without any connection to result. So I'm not here with you, Amanda, because I'm expecting any result from what we're doing here together. I'm just here with you right now. And, you know, in this kind of attention economy world where everyone's vying for your focus and concentration moment to moment, you're getting pings and dings from all sorts of directions. Like, can you really gift someone the present of your presence? You know, just be all there with someone. And so those are the four almost like the biomarkers for spirituality, if you will.
I love those. I've never heard them laid out like that. And I think that's a really beautiful way to gauge where you are. And when you really feel all four of those, that's like true joy. And you really, really feel at peace with yourself. And it's so funny that I feel like these have been practiced for millennia. And now we finally have like research on mindfulness, which is the fourth one you touched on. And where finally our research is catching up to what has been practiced for many of years.
Yeah, now we can measure cortisol levels going down and gray matter growing and, you know, new neurons. Yeah. You know, generating, et cetera. But somehow we intuited all this stuff 2,500 years ago under a Bodhi tree.
I think that that's a huge issue in our society today is how disconnected we are from each other, but from ourselves. It's hard to even see like what is causing me illness or what is causing me harm because people aren't living in the moment. And yeah, I think there's just a disconnect between each other and also ourselves and what we feel. So these intuitive thoughts that we used to have are a little bit more difficult to obtain now.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I used to kind of poo-poo intuition as kind of a woo-woo kind of concept. Poo-poo the woo-woo. you know, I read a lot about, you know, how kind of going with your gut is slightly overestimated, because we always think about it in terms of regret, like, oh, I should have gone with my gut because my gut told me, my gut instinct told me to do one thing or another. But I sort of started to think about intuition as a little different. It's really, it's more of a refined ability to kind of recognize patterns and feelings within the body. And it's in a way, it's a skill. It's not just like, you know, something that serendipitously randomly pops up, you know? And so I put more stake, more shareholder value in intuition than I used to.
Okay. So you have had over 500 podcast episodes, and I really loved your musings in your 500th episode. But what are some of the takeaways that you've had with these conversations and writings that you've had over the years with your commune podcast? And what are some of the things that, some themes that you've noticed throughout? And what are some of the takeaways that you've had?
Yeah, well, of course, over 510 episodes now, I've had a lot of different conversations. So I've gone down a lot of bumpy back roads. But yeah, I think what you were pointing to, that particular episode really put its thumb on, you know, some of the consilient themes or convergences that I started to see across all of my different conversations, whether they were with like a neuroscientist or a regenerative farmer or a mindfulness person or someone in the sociopolitical world. I started to understand sort of a greater concept of what well-being was and how it was reflected. And, you know, the theme there was I started to see wellness or well-being as really a product of balance. And I started to see that kind of everywhere I looked, like in economics, for example, you know, the healthiest societies sort of have a balance of wealth distribution. It's generally, if you wanted to put it on a two-dimensional page, it looks like a bell curve, right? Where the distribution of wealth is very concentrated in the middle class. And, you know, you could think about that too in terms of just what, you know, Main Street used to look like, you know, with a local newspaper and a local jazz club and a local market. But of course, increasingly now we have, you know, media, like five media conglomerates that, like, you know, own all of the media channels. And we have, you know, consolidation amongst, you know, food and grocery and every other kind of thing. So essentially, like, you know, we have now communities that can only shop at 7-Eleven and whatnot. So, you see where balance creates health and where imbalances create sort of disease on every level. So you can look at agriculture, for example. You know, we used to grow, you know, gardens with all sorts of varietals. And we know that, you know, biodiversity is central to health as it pertains to nature. But more and more, we've gotten away from balance. We've gone to monoculture, monocropping, where we grow just like subsidized GMO cash crops or whatever, corn and sorghum and soy and wheat. And of course, then that upsets sort of the health and wellness of the soil, for example. So you could look at politics. You know, right now, of course, you don't have to look very far to see how imbalanced our politics are. We have, you know, kind of a flattening middle and then kind of spikes at the extremes. And again, you know, healthy systems are balanced. They kind of cluster towards the middle. They're bushy, you know, and I could see that in almost every conversation I had. And then, you know, as it became more focused on human physiology, I started to see balance as so central to health. And of course, you know this as a doc, but in human physiology, balance is called homeostasis. So, you know, what we're looking for is homeostasis in between our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, between kind of the various teeter-totter hormones like cortisol and melatonin that we talked about, or between insulin and glucagon, or neurotransmitters between excitatory neurotransmitters like glutamate, but we also need inhibitory neurotransmitters like GABA. And we're always trying to foster this very, very sensitive, tenuous balance. And when we do, we tend to thrive and we tend to step into health and well-being. And so if health is the product of balance, well, of course, the inability to maintain balance, imbalance is really the source of disease. And we can see that everywhere we look. So if you cannot find homeostasis in your blood sugar or your blood glucose levels, for example, and you're hyperglycemic, well, that's going to lead to prediabetes and diabetes, and that's the precursor for heart disease, et cetera. And you can go on and on and on and see where all of the imbalances in your body can lead to disease. If you're in a constant state of stress or sympathetic overload or amygdala hijack or however you want to talk about that, and you're overstressing your HPA axis and your adrenals are producing too much cortisol and you're always in that fight or flight state, well, you know what's going to happen. Your immune system is going to become imbalanced. Your gut is going to go into dysbiosis and eventually develop intestinal permeability. You're going to, of course, again, raise blood sugar levels because cortisol is going to stimulate the production of glucose and release of glucose from the liver. So again, it's like, over and over again, I just started to see this concept of balance being so central to health and well-being in every system. So, you know, that's what I would say. If you're feeling off, then try to understand what is that teeter-totter that exists kind of within your life, whether that's psychological or physiological, and try to, you know, really do the things that cultivate that sensitive balance.
I love that so much. My grandma told me from like very, very young childhood, everything in moderation, everything in balance. And now it's definitely coming to fruition.
I mean, we call, you know, a serene and tranquil state of mind, we call that centeredness, you know? So stay in the center, you know, that's what I always try to do. You know, don't assign advantage or disadvantage to any particular situation too quickly. Don't be too quick to judge this is good and this is evil, et cetera. Just try to find and cultivate that sense of equipoise or centeredness in your life. And, you know, I think you'll be a lot happier.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite rotations that I've done so far in residency is UCLA. It's pretty much UCLA's version of integrative medicine, the East-West medicine. Mm-hmm. It's a specific clinic that is integrative medicine focused, but with a specific bend towards traditional Chinese medicine. And yin and yang is so central to Chinese medicine, where there's a balance between dark and light all the time. And that is the main crux of what they believe is that balance and the opposing forces and always having to be centered. And they have a backlog of people waiting months and months and months to get in because that's what everyone needs right now.
Yeah. No, I call that the Tao of health, you know, using the yin yang as the great sort of iconic symbol to depict balance. And of course, the yang has a little bit of yin in it, and the yin has a little bit of yang in it. So, you know, if you think about like what constitutes strength, you know, yes, strength, you know, you need like muscle for strength, but strength also requires some degree of yin, of some degree of suppleness, you know, and you can see this like in the boughs of a willow tree, for example. If it was laden with a heavy snow, you know, the willow trees, you know, the branches are strong, but they're going to bend a tiny bit and the snow is just going to like slough off, you know, and that's what real strength is versus like an oak tree that's just going to hold strong and then eventually those boughs will snap. And so I think, you know, there's so much to learn from this kind of ancient from Eastern mysticism and Eastern philosophy in general, and applying that to the empiricism of Western medicine, that's kind of, I think, where the honey hole is. It's like, you know, being able to combine those in an intelligent way.
Yeah, absolutely. My family is actually from Macau. I'm not sure if you've... Yeah. So we had a lot of Eastern traditions that was brought into my family. And so I grew up with both Western and Eastern philosophies. And I think one of the things in wellness right now, too, is personal wellness versus societal wellness. So the individual cultures versus the more communal cultures. And it's an interesting push and pull, just like the balance, to see people pursuing wellness, but not for themselves individually, without realizing that it's the whole, like everyone is connected with each other.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think societal wellness can start with personal wellness. I believe that kind of inflammation in the human body kind of spills over into inflammation in the body politic, if you will. You know, if you wake up essentially and you've got multiple chronic diseases and you can't afford your insulin and you're working two part-time jobs at minimum wage, like, you're probably going to be like pretty fucking depressed and pissed off. And that's going to spill over into society. And that's what we're seeing at large, kind of within American culture anyways. And so I think one of the ways, you know, to address societal inflammation is just simply to focus on making people healthier, you know, and that would go an incredibly long way to finding that balance in our society and our socio-political life. And then I think that there's just solutions that are intersectional in nature. Like, for example, like regenerative farming is such a good one, because essentially if we were to raise our food in a regenerative way, not only would we be healing our soil, but we would be growing more nutrient-dense plants, which would then provide greater health and wellness to the individual, while also healing the land and sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. So with one simple practice, you can address agriculture, you can address environmental climate cancer, and you can address human cancer and health. So these are the kinds of intersectional solutions that I'm always like kind of looking for, that cross individual and planetary and, you know, human health.
I love that. I got my master's in public health at the same time I was getting my MD. And my
piece... You're kidding. You're epic. I didn't do that. That's crazy.
It was, it was a combined degree.
Okay.
But my thesis on my public health degree was how regenerative agriculture can be a solution to environmental degradation, this environmental crisis, because it is so intersectional, because it also is better for the farmers. And we have a huge farming community in California.
Huge. I actually forgot to bring up that point. But yeah, I mean, just for not only like the profitability of the farmers, local economies, but also the farmers' health, you know, just their underlying health. They're not like sprayed and coated in pesticides and herbicides. So it checks virtually every box under the sun. And you know, sometimes I'm like, God, I should just be focusing on just that one issue because of the intersectionality of it. But that's amazing that you focused on that, because I think, you know, if more doctors and more people from all sorts of different occupations can really bring this cross-sectional knowledge to the world right now, that's just going to have a huge long tail. So well done.
Thank you. Jeff, this has been such a wonderful conversation. I'm so glad that we got to spend time together. And I have one last question that we ask all of our guests. We ask everyone to finish the following sentence. The future is blank.
Well, I may give you a disappointing answer, but I would say the future is an illusion. The future never really comes. Like, tomorrow is never here. We just really live in the ever now. And in many ways, our attachment to the future and to certain results can cause an incredible amount of suffering. I mean, so much of our anxiety, honestly, our projections are really just phantoms of our own projection. We're anxious about something that hasn't even happened yet, and we're focused on that thing in the future, and then we're anxious about the anxiety, and then we're anxious about the anxiety's anxiety, and we just kind of start to stack these bricks of anxiety like masons. And I would just say, like, let's just try to be here now. Let's just try to be present with each other without attachment to any result in the future. And I think that would go a long way for personal and planetary health.
That was the least disappointing answer. That was beautiful. Wonderful.
Well, I was thinking maybe you want some glorious vision of the future. I don't know. I can't give you that. And I'm not saying that we don't plan. We obviously planned to have this conversation, and that at one point existed in the future. But here we are. We're here now. And to be honest, I think, you know, that's where we find the most joy in life, is when we're completely immersed in some sort of collective enterprise. Like, we're here having this conversation. I'm completely here with you. And it's wonderful. And, you know, we see that, we experience that in collective enterprise with other people. We experience that when we're creative and just immersed in our work or coming up with ideas or playing music or dancing. You know, like, you know, my daughters are dancers. My two little daughters are dancers. And, you know, sometimes their grandfather would say, "Why do you spend so much time dancing? There's no future in it." And I'm like, "That's exactly right. There is no future in it. That's exactly why they should do it."
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love that. Yeah. And I think something that you said too about people just building on their anxieties. I see so, so much anxiety in the clinic. And it is really about the future and thinking about what is to come and what to expect and what is this going to come of that. And living in the here and now is definitely more, brings more peace.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Well, what a treat, Amanda. Thank you so much. I really enjoy being with you.
Thank you. I did as well. Thank you so much for joining us.